It's only April.
There's a lot of people who've put a tremendous amount of work into this bill. I mean, it started with a work group, and there are numerous members here in attendance in the audience. There are people behind this dais now that have done a tremendous amount of work, very thoughtful, contemplative, deliberate legislation to get us to this point. I want to stress that this bill is still a work in progress, and that we have, I think, several good ideas to make this good bill even better. So as we go forth, all of your input is very welcome and much appreciated. This is something that's been a very collaborative, inclusive team effort, and for that alone, I am very pleased and very proud. With that, let me have Mr. Bacovian read the staff summary.
Thank you, Chair. Just before that, I just want to point out at your place on the dais is a yellow book. These were ordered really a couple months ago. They're free publications from the Kaiser Foundation and is a pretty comprehensive resource guide on Medicaid. Anybody in the audience who might be interested, it is a free book, and we can get you information later on it. Also in front of you is really just a kind of a bulleted version of a preliminary staff measure summary titled House Bill 3624 Provisions and Background, and I also put out copies for the public. And it's broken out basically, just kind of did a summary by section. In section one of the bill, the basics, what it does there is requires people who are eligible for medical assistance, the Oregon Health Plan, basically who reside in an area served by a fully capitated health plan, or as we're referring to an FCHIP, are required to enroll in an FCHIP program. That section one also defines enrollment capacity when an FCHIP does have the ability to actually enroll someone in the program, and it sets out the criterion there. Section two eliminates the requirement that providers be reimbursed at rates that cover the cost of services, and then authorizes a fee-for-service system simply as a backup to a primary system of managed care. Again, the kind of overriding components of the bill try to steer most people in fee-for-service into a managed care system. Section 4 directs the Department of Human Services, who oversees our Oregon Health Plan, to contract with physician care organizations, and then it goes on to define what a physician care organization or PCO is. And Section 5 then allows HHS to accept financial contributions from that PCO to help implement the program to kind of bring it up and running. Section 6 requires DHS to contract with FCHIPs to manage services for the medical assistance clients who receive fee-for-service, who are in a fee-for-service arrangement. There'll be people who cannot actually enroll in a FCHIP, but the intent of the bill is to at least have their services managed by an FCHIP program to the extent possible. And then that Section 6 also outlines the process that'll be used to get folks in the fee-for-service arrangement setting into management by an FCHIP, kind of sets out the criterion and the process. Section 8 of the bill requires DHS consult with FCHIP programs in the process of developing capitation rates for the programs. DHS in the past has uses a private actuary and sets rates. This basically will outline a new method by which plans and the state will consult with each other in developing that whole process. Section 9 adds different health-related services that DHS is required to contract with FCHIPs. The idea is to move more services from state management to local management when possible. And that section also specifies the types of prescription drugs which state must pay for directly. Right now, all mental health drugs are carved out or paid for directly by the state. This will just carve out antipsychotic drugs, and perhaps Dr. Bates can elaborate on that later if we need to. Section 10 then goes into a lot of detail about reimbursement rates for hospitals, prohibits hospitals from declining to treat an FCHIP client. when a hospital does not have a contract with an FCHIP, the hospital would have to accept Medicaid fee-for-service rates for that person being treated from the FCHIP, and then if the FCHIP can, it can go ahead and develop a contract with a hospital other than the fee-for-service rate. Section 11 outlines a new way in which FCHIPs can purchase prescription drugs through a pharmacy benefit manager, and Section 12 outlines how the FCHIPs will work with DHS in developing that proposal for PBMs, and then review ways to decrease the administrative burden, decrease the cost for administering programs overall. On the back, Section 13 directs the state to negotiate supplemental rebates for prescription drugs. 14 directs DHS to seek federal approval to use basically a modified health care package being designed or coming out of the Health Services Commission. And then 15 will require DHS to verify residence and financial eligibility of each person enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. I won't go through the background information. This is just some little bit of history and facts and figures related to those sections.
Have we made sure that these are available?
Yes.
Okay.
Should be enough out there.
Very good. Any questions from the committee or discussion? Questions for Mr. Bukovian or Dr. Bates or myself?
Is there, as I read the requirement to enroll in a fully capitated healthcare system, is there any further on down here for the fully capitated healthcare systems to have capacity requirements? I mean, to allow capacity.
We spent quite a bit of time
further down here somewhere than I
think. You know, on defining capacity and actually, you know, a mechanism that if they couldn't assign assign an enrollee to a PCP within 21 days, I believe it is.
I remember that one. But it's not to allow them to say, we can take 45,000, that's all we can take.
We have one provider, no.
No, and they have to assign them within 21 days. I mean, I don't know if it should be 14. I don't know if it should be 30, but we can massage that number. They just can't go, yeah, I'll take everyone left over in the state. And that's not the intent to have that kind of, you know, rush to justice, if you will, rush to fee-for-service at all. I mean, there needs to be, you know, some oversight on that. So, fair question. Representative Bates.
To flush that out in the other direction also, there was a concern on the plan's part that at times their capacity is being defined in such a way that they really could take more patients, but because they had restraints on them about how fast that patient had to be seen. As an example, patient calls in the first day they're up and says, I want a history and physical done, and they're told, well, you know, the normal wait for any patient for that might be 4 or 5 months or 3 months, whatever the doctor's doing at that time. That would preclude them from being allowed into the plan. The plans are telling us we'll be able to take care of those people on an emergent basis, even in the office, send them to the emergency room, but we don't want our capacity restricted by on the basis of we have to be able to give routine health care immediately when they're enrolled in the plan. That's what this is trying to get to. Hit that in between area that's realistic and fair.
Very good. Any other questions of staff or committee member to committee member? If not, let's get right into the public hearing. But first, I'd like to. Does anybody have a cardboard cutout of Jeff Cruz? I mean,
I thought Jeff that would be was redundant. A cardboard cutout.
Jeff? let me call up as a group Karen Whitaker from OHSU Rural Health Services and Ed Patterson, Oregon Rural Health Association. Enter and sign in, please. And you have to get real friendly with those microphones. That's why we have the high-tech elevation devices available.
Okay. You ready for me to begin? Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the Oregon State Office of Rural Health, which is located at Oregon Health and Science University. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to share my views with you regarding House Bill 3624. I really want to commend you for having the commitment and creativity to propose options that will preserve the Oregon Health Plan. I know it's something that all of us are very concerned about. At the same time, I want to ask you to proceed with caution in suggesting a one-size-fits-all approach. I know that all of you on this committee are sensitive to the differences between the urban and rural healthcare environments because we've talked about it many times before. You appreciate the fragility of rural clinics and most rural hospitals, and so I'm asking you to take a few minutes to consider the impact of House Bill 3624 as written on rural healthcare systems and to consider this in context with the other changes that are proposed right now. I understand that capitated managed care with its attendant savings may indeed be the best delivery system overall for the Oregon Health Plan. And in order to create incentives for providers to participate in managed care, the state has intentionally reduced the potential reimbursement rate under fee-for-service. Right now it equals about 30% of the costs of providing care. So let's start with the premise that capitated managed care is dependent on spreading risk over a large population in order to make it work. The New England Journal of Medicine estimate, for example, which has been used as a standard, is 100,000 lives. I don't need to tell you that this number is not attainable in rural parts of the state, and most of you are aware that most prepaid capitated managed care organizations have left the rural parts of the state and don't do business there any longer. So let's not try to fit an urban solution to rural problems, and let's not penalize remote rural hospitals because they exist in areas that have sparse populations. Oregon's seven frontier hospitals operated at a combined deficit of minus $5 million during the last available audited year, 2001, which was an average annual loss of $751,400 per hospital. At the same time, the current 03-05 budgets propose that cost-based Medicaid reimbursement to Type A and Type B rural hospitals be discontinued, and that all hospitals no longer have the advantage of presumptive eligibility for Medicaid patients. In fact, that change has already taken place. Estimated losses for rural hospitals in the next biennium include almost $7 million in losses for Type A hospitals under if and when the cost-based reimbursement is eliminated, $17 million in losses to Type B hospitals if and when the cost-based reimbursement is eliminated, and a little more than $8 million in losses to the A and B hospitals upon elimination of presumptive eligibility. I know that all of you are weary of hearing the dire predictions, and I won't try to use alarmist tactics with you. But I do know that you rely on people like me to let you know what the impact is of your decisions. And the impact of House Bill 3624 as written would almost certainly be the closure of several fragile rural hospitals. I would be very happy to work with you to come up with some alternative language that would protect these important resources. Thank you.
Any questions for Karen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What if you could tell me why you're particularly concerned about Type A and Type B's? They are specifically in this bill cut out from this, and they're excluded from this in Section 10. I'm obviously missing something here, so you help me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, they are excluded from this bill, but in the governor's budget and in the co-chair's budget, the Type A and Type B reimbursement is eliminated.
I understand that.
And so there would be a conflict there that would have to be resolved.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I understand that, but I just want to make sure there's nothing in this bill that you were concerned about, because we were very careful to draft this in a way that would allow some flexibility. We clearly understand that some areas of the state cannot be under managed care and probably never will be. Others will be that are. And we want to go that direction when it's feasible and reasonable. But we understand that there are very special conditions that don't allow that to happen.
Right, yeah. I'm just urging you to consider it all in context. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I guess I would, and I don't know this, but I'll bet you milkshake right now, and Patterson's got to buy either way, whether you win or I win. But you stated that you were under the opinion, you're of the opinion that most rural counties don't have fully capitated health care coverage. I would think that not to be true. I mean, I know we've got Curry and Tillamook, Baker, probably some in Sherman. I'm running out of gas after that.
Mr. Chair, you're probably correct. That isn't exactly what I meant to say, if that's okay. What I said. I did say that most of the plans have left rural areas. ODS, Blue Cross Blue Shield, they could not cultivate enough commercial business to make it worthwhile to continue to do Medicaid business in those counties, and so they no longer operate there. The CONET, the Central Oregon Independent Health System, the IPA that's associated with CONET, does operate in many rural counties, but it is the only capitated plan that does.
Well, COLIS operates in 10.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. So, I like strawberry. Karen likes chocolate.
I want a malt.
All right. Yeah. And we want it at the Space Needle, Patterson.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on the question Dr. Bates asked, it sounds from your closing testimony when you say, as written, would be this bill would certainly cause a closure of rural hospitals. And then I just want to make sure I understood your answer is that it isn't really this bill, it's the provision in the governor's budget which doesn't fund A and B hospitals that is the issue?
Representative Merkley, Mr. Chair, I think I probably wasn't as clear about that as I should have been. I think if you require hospitals to accept the rural hospitals to accept fee-for-service, which is at about 30% of cost right now. If there is no fully capitated health plan, then those hospitals are definitely going to suffer as a result. So I think we need to put some provision in there to protect some level of small rural hospitals.
Okay, thank you.
Do we not do that?
No, we do not right now. Well, we have the type A and the type B cost-based reimbursement, yes. But we need to be very definite about preserving that, and we need to look at it in the overall
context. Okay, so the answer to the question is yes, you do that in the bill. You just want to emphasize the point that we need to be vigilant in protecting that provision.
That's
which
correct.
Is in the bill.
And it would also be helpful to protect them from the loss of the presumptive eligibility requirement as well.
Let's cut to the chase then. Would you rather operate without a Medicaid program or with one?
Well, Representative March, of course we need to have a Medicaid program, and it's certainly better to get some reimbursement than none at all. But with the changes that are currently forecast in the Oregon Health Plan, with so many people losing coverage, they're almost certainly going to seek primary care in hospital emergency departments, and that's something that we need to consider as well.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to salvage the ship, you know, and get a few more people on the lifeboats.
I certainly appreciate that. I'm not at all minimizing your efforts in that regard.
Any other questions for Karen? Mr. Patterson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ed Patterson. I'm representing the Oregon Rural Health Association. Our association membership consists of 41 separate organizations, including 24 hospitals, 6 rural health clinics, 9 professional organizations, 2 OHSU rural health organizations, and over 270 individual members around the state. We've been in operation for about 12 years now. I guess I would disagree somewhat with what
Ed,
Karen said.
Can you get just a little closer to that mic?
Mr. Chairman, given what Representative Bates indicated, that the bill does not do harm to A and B rural hospitals but excludes them from the provisions of the bill, My reading of the bill is that it does not do that. I'm pleased to hear that that was the intent. But the counsel I received indicated it doesn't do that, and my testimony relates to exactly that point. And it begins with Section 10. Section 10 states, subsection 1, states that all hospitals other than A and B rural hospitals receiving payment for health services on a fee-for-service basis shall be reimbursed for inpatient services on a DRG basis and be reimbursed for other services on a percentage of Medicare reimbursement rates. This would appear to preclude the rural hospitals. But the way it's written in Section 10, it only precludes the rural hospitals, as alluded to in subsection 1. If you go into Section 10, subsection 4, it states that a hospital that does not have a contract to provide services must accept the reimbursement rates as established under subsection 1, meaning going back into the provision that I just read on subsection 1. Since subsection 4 does not exclude rural hospitals, a rural hospital without a contract would be required to accept the reimbursement rates described in subsection 1, in effect subverting the current law requiring Medicaid cost-based reimbursement to rural hospitals. Secondarily, it puts a very difficult position, puts a hospital in a very difficult position if he's negotiating a contract, because the contractor could always let the cost-based reimbursement go back to fee-for-service. Now, that's our interpretation of the way the bill is written, maybe not the intent, but that's the concern that we have. As an example, in Section 2, Subsection 1B establishes the fee-for-service as a backup to primary system of managed care health service. That basically is what occurs now, and that's not anything dramatic just in Subsection 2 alone. However, if you read Section 10, sub 3, it states a hospital may not decline to treat an individual who receives health services from a fully capitated plan. In effect, the hospital would be required to treat all plan patients and be reimbursed on a fee-for-service basis, not on a cost basis. Now, we believe that this would indeed put rural hospitals, all rural hospitals, in an awkward position, and that the way the bill appears to be written to us, is that it subverts the cost-based reimbursement currently as state law, regardless of what happens between the co-chair's budget and the governor's budget to eliminate that. Obviously, Karen is right. That in and of itself would be a disaster. But this bill, if this bill is intended not to affect Type A and B rural hospitals, it appears there needs to be some clarifying language in the way the bill is written.
Mr. Chair?
No, ahead.
I'll check with LC on this, because obviously that was not our intent, okay? And I'll go back and make sure the language reflects that, so that, in fact, A and B hospitals are excluded from this. This is really designed to get to a significant problem in the Portland area, the Tri-County area. It is not meant to be a part of any A and B hospitals. So we'll go back and make sure that happens, and I'll get an LC opinion on it, and you can see that opinion with me.
Representative Bates, look forward to seeing the amendment.
Well, if it does something, I mean, I've read this four times as Ed's been talking, and I still read it the way I've always read it. The Department of Human Services shall reimburse all hospitals, comma, other than type A and B hospitals as defined in ORS 442 and identified by the Office of Rural Health as rural hospitals. And then it goes into the conditions. Says we'll pay him, except the payment method is this, except for these hospitals. So, I mean, that's how I'm still reading that, and I'm happy to work with you, you know, to achieve even more clearly the intent that I think we both share.
Mr. Chair, that's all I can tell you. Pleased to hear that, because when I just got the bill yesterday afternoon, and that's a pretty brief analysis of it, and we have not had legal counsel actually look at it yet, so we'd appreciate that.
Well, that puts you and I on the same playing field, Ed. Neither one of us are attorneys.
That means I get a vanilla milkshake, right?
As long as you pay and it's at the Space Needle, that's okay.
I assume the committee has to be there with you?
Well, there needs to be supervision and oversight. You know, it's one of the things that I think we need to spruce up in the bill, but that's a whole different story. Any other questions for Karen and Ed? Thank you very much for
being here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mike, are you going back anywhere? Are you going back tonight? Are you camped in Salem or tonight? Enter and sign in, please.
Sure.
Yeah. 100.002.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for your kind indulgence. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Due to a last-minute hallway conversation, actually a restroom conversation, I've changed my speech and I'm going to limit my remarks to the delivery system and say nothing about funding. I was advised that that would be apropos and that the funding can be discussed ad infinitum at another point.
Did you identify yourself, Cedric?
I did not. You did. You said my name. Cedric Hayden, Fall Creek, Oregon. Thank
you,
Mr. Chairman. So, good evening, committee. I want to discuss tonight the delivery system. Consistent with Section 7, which is on page 3, line 39, existing law, not amended by this committee, says the commission shall actively solicit public involvement in a community meeting process. This process has gone on at some length. If I can lapse into a French ballad, in my youth I was enamored with the song that said, Michel, ma belle, these are words that go together well. Some words that go together well that might be appropriate for this committee are doctor and dentist, sugar and salt, medical dental, peaches and cream. Some words just go together well. And I would not want you to write a bill discussing doctors that didn't have the word dentist there also, doctor and dentist. So continuing with our discussion of the delivery system, we hold these facts to be self-evident that the healthcare delivery system does and of right should include dental care for poor people. I would urge that the healthcare delivery system maintain at least a skeletal system, and I know you have to make cuts, but I would urge that it maintain at least a skeletal system of adult dental care, including seniors, poor pregnant women, and other medically vulnerable people. And with the framework there, it can be fleshed out at another time, another session perhaps. I would further, number two, I would urge that the delivery system include the CHIP kits, and there are some economic advantages to doing that. Number three, I would urge that the delivery system include kids through age 20. Currently, you include them through age 19, but under the federal mandates, you can include them through age 20. I agree that Section 1, page 1, Section 1, subsection 4, subsection A is good, where it says that you are supportive of a fully capitated managed care delivery system, and I applaud your decision for that. I would point out that on lines 18 through 20, a prepaid managed care health services organization, which is, and prepaid managed care health service organizations include managed health, dental, or mental health organizations. They may be dental care organizations, fully capitated health plans, mental health organizations, physician care organizations, and et cetera. It talks about that if an applicant resides in an area designated by a zip code that is not served by a fully capitated health plan, the applicant must enroll in a plan for health services offered by a prepaid managed care health services organization. That would include dental care organizations. Mr. Chairman, I just for the record and to reinforce it, I want you to understand that dental care organizations are statewide. We are in every zip code. And so whatever individuals you choose to cover, kids, adults, seniors, we can cover them statewide under this section. I appreciate your hard work, and I look forward very much to continuing this discussion, perhaps in another committee.
Let me clarify something you said, Cedric, just so my understanding is correctly. But now every square inch of the state is covered by a managed dental care organization.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. According to our contracts, if we have a clinic every 60 miles, within 60 miles of driving distance the state is covered, and OMAP can, and under this bill should, enroll every dental patient in managed care, and no more fee-for-service. That's the point I was trying to make. Right. Thank you for refreshing me.
Any questions for Cedric?
Impressive. Got the whole state covered.
You know, I'll deny this if I hear I said it, but I really miss seeing you around here. That's okay. I can't say it again.
The song you really want, however, is Love and Marriage.
Thank you, Cedric.
Thank you.
Michael?
I'm Dr. Mike Shercliffe. My residence is in Redmond. My business is in Roseburg. Like many of you, I know the world well back and forth. I appreciate the opportunity to testify again before. I did not write my testimony because you've got more copies of it than you really want to read. I've testified many times before. Our organization is called Northwest Dental Services. We're a cooperative of 250-plus dentists in the state of Oregon. We were organized in a way so we could provide dental health care for rural citizens. We presently have about 60,000 Oregon Health Plan recipients in 20 different counties, and without managed care, we would not be able to do that. We're able to. I'm here in support of the bill that supports managed care, because without it, we can't take the dollars and put them in a way where we can prioritize care. As you know, one of the fallacies, particularly in rural Oregon, is rural health care, is the incentives are production of services rather than manage of the disease process. And one thing we've been able to do because of managed care is allocate the resources in a way that allows the dollars to go where they should go, for ultimately we begin to see less cost. An example of that is that the dental care system that you presently have has not had an increase in fees for 4 years. And what we've been able to do is manage those dollars more and more effectively. Another thing we've been able to do, particularly in Representative Chair Westland's district, is been able to change the incentives so that the pediatric care is now getting directed more towards care in the offices rather than in the hospital care. And we've been able to do that by putting incentives such that prevention can get paid for versus stainless steel crowns, pulpotomies, and things like that. So we're really in favor of the managed care system that's been created. We'd hate to see that it got dismantled.
Excuse me, Mike.
Yeah.
Jeff, if you're going to come raid our cookies, will you at least get one for the delightful young lady that's sitting in the third row? I am ashamed of your manners. That is absolutely atrocious. Excuse me, Mike. But some breaches of protocol are just, you know, unforgivable. Please continue.
With that, I should close my testimony, but... Anyway, we're here to support the managed care system. We hope that when I read the bill, I hope that it includes the dental care organizations, because they have been the most effective for providing managed care across the state. It's a unique blend of people. You have the Oregon Dental Association's affiliated company, Oregon Dental Service. You have Willamette Dental, which is Northwest Dental Services, Hayden Family Dentistry, MultiCare, Capital Dental, and Managed Dental Care of Oregon, which, truthfully, the penetration for dental managed care is 82%. And most of what you see not in managed care in dentistry is a churning that goes on, people going in and out, in and out, in and out, which this bill attempts to help. And so we support this. We hope that... I realize there's a lot more to this, and we hope that the managed care structure can be continued for not only the fully capitated health plans, but also the dental care organizations as well as the mental health organizations, because I think that for this particular population, it's the best way to allocate and manage the resources. Also, it goes along with the spirit of the Oregon Health Plan, and so I hope that through the process that the prioritized list, which really has been an effective tool, is not eliminated. And finally, I hope that the piece of this bill that makes me nervous, I hope it doesn't cherry pick the prioritized list and pick out services and throw them away. I don't think it does, but when I read it, a cursory reading, you can read it either way. And so I hope that I know the intent of the authors of this bill, and so I hope that that's what I think the bill says. So I appreciate that, and appreciate all the hard work of the committee and in the time that they've taken. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Cedric or Michael?
Did either of you bring a toothbrush for the young lady?
I've got about a half. I've got a dozen out in the car, so I could run and get one if she did.
Well, you might check with.
Knowing her father, I know that when she gets home tonight, they'll get scrubbed and she'll get some fluoride, and I'm sure her head will not reach the pillow without clean teeth. So,
okay.
All right, thanks.
You know, before you guys leave the dais, I want to say something. I walked down, as most of us have here, a lot of trails of tears with both these guys over the five special sessions, and then even carrying on into the work group with Steve Petroselli. And I really want to compliment not only your collaborative, you know, abilities, your ability to compromise, but your very nimble, you know, creative approach to trying to make this whole thing work. You obviously know and can see that your song Doctors and Dentists aren't walking down the same lane in this bill, Cedric, but you know, we've still got quite a bit of time to go, and let's just keep working at it. But again, I really appreciate the way you guys go about doing what you do.
It's hard to imagine, Mr. Chair, that I appreciate those words. It's hard to imagine that the people in the state of Oregon don't consider dental care as health care. If any of you have ever had the opportunity of having a toothache or need the assistance of a dentist, we're popular people. I understand that there's a perception out there that dentistry is something that just the rich get, but very frankly, in the state of Oregon, 65% of all people have dental insurance. And to take the vulnerable, like the elderly, poor, the disabled, and pregnant women, to take them and not... where do they get their resources for this? I know you have a... this is not a resource time here, but I hope that we can find some way to fit them in. And we're willing to sit down and work with you to help you save some more money, too, when we get to that point. Thanks.
You bet.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Thomas Holt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association.
And just so everyone knows, Tom was a member of our original work group. Many nights and cold pizza.
And we appreciate the opportunity we've had so far to be able to be part of the development of this. And I'm going to be brief, as many others are. We're just really going through this language today. But some initial reactions, concerns to this work in progress. One, as we have said before, we have some concern about the 100% managed care model. This would be probably the only state in the country to have that if we were to proceed in that direction. Nobody else has succeeded on that piece of ground, and we just have a concern that we might be treading where others have already tried and failed, and we're not certain if that works. In terms of the drug pieces in particular, the sections 6, 11, and 13, which all relate to who manages the drugs, would appear to be, at first read anyway, internally contradictory in terms of the what happens with rebate negotiations. Section 5, if a managed care organization of any kind is at risk for the drugs, then once the drugs go under managed care management, then there are no rebates available to the state. As we read this, at least initially, by the time we get down to section 13, which talks about a pool, there isn't going to be much to pool. We'll just point that out. And in Section 5, to the extent that a single organization would then be at risk for, among other things, prescription drugs, then the rebate income to the state would appear to entirely go away. Those are just some initial concerns. We think that there's, at least looking at this in an initial analysis where we have other folks who are experts on the language, the lawyer types looking at it, but we'd like to be able to continue to work with you on this project and maximize the state's ability to save costs here.
Very good. I disagree with your interpretation. I know you guys just got this, and you know there's quite a few subtleties in here that represent a great deal of thought. I mean, they're more than implications. They're going to, should you know, a past constitutional muster become statutory. But the the first interpretation I take some exception to is. And nowhere in here does it say we're getting to 100% of managed care. I mean, if I could push a magic button and make that happen and make that work, I mean, I would jump all over that with both feet. But we may be clod kickers from Culver up here, but we're not quite that naive. However, I do expect a significant increase in the enrollment of managed care. So I don't know where you're getting that read. It kind of goes back to Mitch's question. You know, no, there's a process where they the existing managed care organizations have to have the capacity to be able to serve those patients and serve them well. Otherwise, you know, they are not a member, you know, of that plan, whatever it might be, regardless of the fact if they're in a geographic area that has zip codes that are covered by managed care. So. You know, if you're seeing something, and that's what this is all about. I mean, that's what this public input process is all about. I appreciate you bringing that to our attention. We'll look at that a little closer. Representative Bates.
I think Representative Merkley was first.
Oh, Representative Merkley.
Well, thank you, Mr.
Look left.
Mr. Chair. your first comment that there are no rebates under managed care, were you speaking to a particular provision in the bill when you said that?
Chair Westland, Representative Merkley, what I'm referring to there is actually the overriding federal rebate law. So if it, drugs that are in fee-for-service are eligible for rebates under the federal rebate law, and if there is a managed care organization managing drugs and is at risk, then they are not eligible under the federal rebate law. The managed care organizations themselves may in fact negotiate for their own rebates, but they are not nearly as large as those available directly through the federal law.
I see. Thank you.
And that is correct, Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I can kind of flesh this out for you what the policy decision was. And we know that the laws have been written on a federal basis that if you are fee-for-service, not at risk, you get rebates up to 15% or higher with supplemental rebates. But you have no significant management in that situation. And so while you gain that situation from the rebates, you lose your management. In a managed care environment where you're at risk not only for the pharmaceuticals but for utilization by physicians and hospital, you're allowed to manage but don't get the rebates. You can probably get 5 or 6% by bulk purchasing, which is what we're intending to do. But the real drive here is we felt we could save more money for the state with managed care than we would with the rebates. And that's a judgment decision on our part, backed by some pretty good data that we come out a little bit ahead in that environment. The 14 managed care plans we have shown an amazing ability to manage these by using more generics, pulling down utilization, and over-prescribing. And so that and those management tools have been effective, we think more effective in driving down drug costs for the state than have the rebates offered by the federal government. And it is a judgment decision to a great degree, but that's what we're looking at. We also, however, want to bifurcate this thing so that when we buy those drugs that go into the fee-for-service market, we would want to get the rebates for those, obviously.
Chair Westland, if I may, and Representative Bates, you know, we would agree that, you know, given the current, all the existing laws in Oregon and regulations that if you took you know, set of drugs in managed care and the same set of drugs in fee-for-service, you have a lot more tools for management and managed care, and that's a policy decision for you all. If you allow, and there's lots of leeway to have management tools in fee-for-service. If you make use of those same or similar management tools in fee-for-service, we believe you would come out considerably ahead of the game. But that's a, you know, that's just a policy decision for you all to make. One thing I did forget to touch on, that, and your mention of bulk purchasing triggered that, is that just the specific language on line 19 on page 3, I think it is, that talks about bulk purchasing. What it, the, if I'm looking in the right place.
Yeah, you are. Well, it's a prescription
drug. Sorry, page 5, line 19, that where it says, and we had some of this discussion in the context of another bill just this morning, and the says the pharmacy benefit manager shall purchase prescription drugs in bulk or reimburse. Our interpretation, as we have looked at very similar language in other legislation, is that when we say purchase prescription drugs in bulk, may have an implication. I'm sure it's not what you all intended in drafting, that the state would take physical possession. So we'd recommend some wordsmithing there, but that's just a minor detail point.
For that 0.001% of the fee-for-service population that we're not going to be able to get to, right? Okay,
you'll
not 100, Tom.
You help with that, right?
Any other questions for Tom? Buddy, we appreciate all your help on this.
Thank you.
We'll keep working on this. I mean, flesh these out. Come see us.
We will bring you.
Read it again 3 or 4 times and find something you hadn't found before. Thanks, Tom. Diana Merriweather. Damiana. I knew that. Yeah, I believe the instructions say please print.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if you read them, you'll notice that the letters are not connected in there. Definitely.
Well, I don't know.
Patterson, although a little thing prints.
We might get Patterson to buy us another milkshake on a bet, you know.
They just don't teach kids like they used to.
I'm not going there. Damiana.
Chair Westland and members of the committee, my name is Damiana Merriweather, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Advocacy Center. Oregon Advocacy Center, as many of you probably know, advocates on behalf of people with disabilities. I know that this bill is a working document in many ways, and I acknowledge that. And to that end, I'm here to point out one section of the bill that we think doesn't have everything it needs in it, and that's Section 1, Subsection 4. In this section...
Wait, excuse me. What was that, Damiana?
That's Section 1, Subsection 4.
Okay, Section 1. All right, I'm with you.
Which requires everyone to be enrolled in a fully capitated plan or to be in fee-for-service that's managed. The one thing that we don't see here is an exemption for people with unique medical needs. Is any parent of a child with severe physical or developmental disabilities will tell you it can be very difficult to find a physician who's both able and willing to meet the unique needs of those folks. And we have concerns that without the possibility of exempting them out so that they can get proper care, they could get stuck in a system where there's no one within a fully capitated plan who's able to meet their unique needs. The current Medicaid plan allows for that exemption, and we would just like to see that included.
Okay. I'm having trouble envisioning, you know, a situation, a child with unique medical needs could be in a very rural community. Most of those get, you know, transported to OHSU. But my impression might be incorrect. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you talking about a situation, and do you have an actual example of one where a family with a child is enrolled in a managed care plan, the family wanted a specific physician or treatment that was not available within the plan, and the plan would not make that referral for them. Is that a common problem you've run into, or is it something you're concerned might happen?
Chair Westland and Representative Bates, I have to admit that this is not my area of expertise, and I was called into service on relatively short notice, so I'm not the best person to speak to specific cases. But I think Ellen Lowe, who's here this evening, is going to be talking about some of these issues as well. And it has come in situations where families have found themselves not being able to access or having to go through a great deal of difficulty to get to a physician who is able and willing to address the needs of their family member and also get properly reimbursed. And through the exemption that exists in the current plan, that's been addressed in Medicaid, and we would just like to see that continue to be addressed. I can return to members of the committee with some more specific information on those sorts of cases. I'm afraid I'm not prepared with that this evening.
But we'll also take it up with some representatives of the plans that have been very involved in this process. But I appreciate you acknowledging you're not an expert in that area, and you've obviously proven that you're not an expert in the area of printing. So we'll talk afterwards. I mean, you tell me these letters aren't connected. Any other points or issues?
No, thank you.
Damiana, thank you very much. Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, appearing this evening on behalf of Pharma, and I want to first begin by, like so many other witnesses I'm sure will do, commending you and the other two musketeers for and just an incredible exertion of effort and dedication to this state. I don't think we haven't seen anything like it in a very long time in this building, and you are incredibly to be commended.
Well, let's just put the record clear. There were a lot of people involved in this, and you were one of them. You were one of the early, very collaborative members of the work group, and we appreciate your efforts as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in that vein, in that spirit, we hope to continue our collaboration. Any critique that I'm offering tonight is strongly to be met in the way of constructive criticism, in the hope that this bill can be made better. We're all in this together, and we've got to figure out somehow to survive to better times. The thing we like best about this bill is the strong push for managed care. That is just it's a terrific theme. It was the underlying theme of the Oregon Health Plan from the very beginning, and I think you've really reemphasized and strengthened that. And contrary to, you know, some popular misconceptions, we're great believers in managed care. The issues that I would like to draw to your attention have to do with what I would call problems when it's not really full managed care, in other words, fully capitated, covering all risks, including hospitalization. And that crops up in a couple of spots in the bill in Section 6, where I think it's Section 6, where the fully caps act in a sort of second capacity as kind of mini PBMs for the fee-for-service population. Where you have a risk at least of creating some silo incentives where they're not responsible essentially for the hospital risk and that goes with that. You see, and you have another kind of related issue in terms of the interaction of Section 6 and Section 11, where the statewide PBM is sort of doing the same pharmacy benefit management that you're asking the fully caps to do with regard to at least some portions of the fee-for-service population. I'm not sure how those will ultimately interact, but it's an issue to explore. A final area of concern, and again, we're still analyzing this. I got the certified smart people looking at this and trying to, you know, parse it all out. Section 5 raises some novel issues, and one of them, I'm not going to address all of them, but one of them has to do with rebates. as I understand the way Section 5 would work, Kaiser would be truly at risk for everything except hospital, for whatever that population would be. When you do that, you're going to lose entitlement to the federally mandated rebate that goes to the state, because it's going to be the RX will be inside a cap rate, essentially. So you will be losing the federally mandated RX rebate. So it becomes extremely important to capture and reflect the rebate that Kaiser will be receiving from our companies, and netting that out in your calculation of the cap rate. This has been an issue that has come up previously prior to the 2001 session, when Price Waterhouse was just doing, to be very candid, a terrible job, and it wasn't capturing this at all. They then went into a kind of actuarially estimated deduct for the rebate that are deemed to be paid to the fully capitated plans by our companies, and that's something like 6% or something. But when you've got this kind of situation with a potential for a very expansive growth in coverage for the PCO, you have to really carefully account for what that rebate is. And I would suggest an actuarial estimate is not good enough. You need to have a full accounting by Kaiser and of what it's getting in rebate on this service, and net that out so there's not an opportunity for inaccurate or inappropriate reimbursement.
Distorted reimbursement.
Well, I mean, I don't know how you would call it, Mr. Chairman, but you want an accurate rate that fully nets out the rebate. And then the final thing I'd like to say is I would still like, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, to continue to explore the option that costs us more money, which is the carve-out of the RX benefit on the fully capitated plans. I fully appreciate your resolution of that issue and Representative Bates' comments. But if there's a way to get the best of both possible worlds and a meaningful management of that, I guess more than meaningful management, meaningful incentive, I think that's still something you ought to look at.
See these eyes?
We've been wrestling with this issue. What's the question isn't how do you buy drugs at the lowest price? We know what that is. It's how do you produce drug utilization at the lowest cost? And we've been round and round and round, and I want to thank Jim Gardner and Stetcher and Spencer. I mean, we sent those guys off with the plans and said, you guys figure out how, when I say the plans, managed care plans, the cheapest way to buy drugs. And I mean, they came back, you know, plans, best interest, lowest cost drugs, along with our pharmaceutical folks. And I mean, they were within about 10% of one another, but what they couldn't quantify really was the utilization.
Right.
And so I really appreciate it. We got the pharmaceutical buyer from Kaiser on the phone. We got one of the certified smart folks from EDS on the phone. And we're still struggling with this. So if anyone out there can figure out how we can get the rebate and yet plug that Medicaid, you know, this is the difficult part, plug that Medicaid drug into a managed care situation to utilize, you know, their formularies and their, you know, their management, their utilization techniques. Well, I'll buy all the milkshakes for everyone in the room. Representative Merkley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you, for those of us who are the non-healthcare experts, can you explain, or can someone here explain, why is it the federal law has this rebate provision related to managed care, and is this something that we can apply for a waiver for?
I have trouble explaining half the things we do, so I don't want to explain, you know, federal policy. But I mean, it's very clear, it's very stated, and it's if you get the rebate, we're talking Medicaid drugs now. You get the rebate, you know, you're entitled to 15.1%. That's a generous rebate. you can't get that into a managed care environment. If you get it into a managed care environment, fine. You're not eligible for the rebate, the federal rebate. You are still eligible for rebates that whatever managed care or buying consortium could get from the individual drug companies. But you can have one, you know, give you anything you want, but I can't get you everything you want. And that is federal law. We're not going to change it. And I highly doubt, although I think it's an intriguing question, if there's a waiver that's available on that particular aspect. Representative Bates, you want to flesh that out?
Yeah, I want to try to get the policy behind this, if I can put this in the right words. And Jim, you may have to help
me. Yeah, and there is some reasoning.
There is some reasoning here. In a managed care environment, you're responsible for hospital costs and physician costs and utilization and the whole ball of wax. And if you were in a position that you could then say that you're going to take one silo like prescription drugs and just hammer that down as much as you could and then not care about what happened to the rest of your costs, that would lead to a distortion of your market. That mean that in the fee-for-service side, since you're not responsible, it works the opposite direction. You don't want to be in a situation where, I'll give you an example. When Prozac first came out, it cost five times as much as the next antidepressant drug. And managed care plan said, we won't use it. It's too expensive. But a good study was done in Washington State showing that if you used it, it drove down the rest of your costs more than the drug cost. We don't want to reproduce the Prozac scenario. And that's what we're trying to, that's what those laws are designed to do. If you're at risk, then you get all the management you want, but you can't get the drug cheap. And if you're going to not be at risk, then you want the drug cheap, and that's fine. And I don't know if I've made that point clear, Jim. Maybe you can do a better job than
I. Can I take a swing at it too, Mr. Chair? I mean, the issue is a straightforward one. When the federal government or its agent, the state government, is buying the drugs, then they're entitled to the lowest price available, which is the Medicaid price. A managed care program, when you turn the money over to a managed care program, the state is no longer buying the drugs. The managed care program is buying the drugs. And it's just one step removed, and the rulings have been that one step takes away the ability to get the state price, since it's no longer the state that's buying it. A managed care program can use that money for anything they want.
In the absence, we still have a chair. If I can follow up with another question. You made the comment, Jim, that under Section 6 there's an encouragement of a silo mentality. Could you maybe amplify on that a bit?
Mr. Chair, it relates precisely to the discussion that you were just hearing from Representative Greenlick and Representative Bates. The problem here is, and again, we are big supporters of managed care, but by managed care, what I mean is fully capitated managed care that centralizes all the risk in one place so that you are, in effect, trading off the benefit of Prozac against the cost of hospitalization. The problem here is that you're going to be contracting for the management of these programs, but you're not going to be placing the people at risk. So it's sort of the flip side of the problem of that the chairman was addressing with regard to carve-out. I mean, they're being compensated to do this, but they're not at risk. So it will be difficult to define a performance metric. Risk is extremely important in this business in terms of sort of inducing rational behavior, I guess is the way I put it.
As a motivator.
Well, okay. Mr. Chair, if I can chase this cougar a little bit with a hound of dogs here, to a pack of hounds.
I'm about to ring the radio collars here.
You mean I stepped out of the yard, huh? I'm sorry Representative Bates and Westland aren't here for this discussion, but at one point we had a proposal somewhere that said, okay, you manage everything. We won't capitate you for drugs, but we'll capitate you for everything else. and we'll pay you a fee for managing a drug program. Now, I've heard Jeff and others say, well, the physicians have to be at dollar risk for this. And frankly, it's my experience that that's not necessarily true. There are circumstances, it seems to me, where physicians can be transparent. But the question is there some structural problem you have with this other than that it might not work? Which isn't in this bill, but it's in things that we talked about.
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, Representative Greenlee, yes, I guess there is, because if you don't have a management inside of a risk environment, you have, and it is frankly the same problem that we were talking about with Representative Westland and the problem of carving out the drug benefit for the fully capitated plan.
Yeah, that's fine.
In that environment, they are at risk for the hospitalization costs, so they're incented to be rational users of drugs that are cost avoiders. The question is, are they going to be too liberal users of drugs that are cost avoiders?
I mean, that's a testable hypothesis, I think. I mean, there are some people hypothesizing, well, they won't behave in the same way if they're not individually at risk. I mean, my experience is much more with Kaiser Permanente, where the physicians are just at very, very weak kind of financial risk or no financial risk, yet working together in groups, they figure out some way to create a new normative structure. They have a P&T committee. Mm-hmm. P&T committee works things out. A formulary, they work things out. 2 out of 100 grumble about it. You say, okay, screw up however you want. We'll worry about you later. I mean, and things eventually work out, even though their program, if you will, is at risk, but they're really isolated from that risk, and yet they eventually work out different behavioral patterns. And that may not be true with a 6-person group, but I mean,
it's
a testable hypothesis.
Let me pull us back, because we're talking about Section 6 here. Right? Is that correct? Mm-hmm. And this is primarily for that whatever small group we have left in the fee-for-service services.
In Washington County.
Well, but that's going to change.
Chair. But I was still wondering, while we're still talking about the bill, why we might not try some experimentation with that other model, which, if it worked, might allow you to get both the Medicaid rebate, since it is being paid for by the state, and the change in behavioral pattern by
state. Perhaps you would like to work on some amendments on the side, mm-hmm. that would allow some demonstration projects, mm-hmm. or something to that effect.
Yeah. Oh, I suppose that is interesting.
Mr. Chair, it's a lot of money, and it's... do more than break even in terms of if the utilization doesn't just eat it all up. I mean, and if Representative Greenlee is correct that there's a collaborative way to do it, I just think it's worth a try. The other thing I wanted to mention, Mr. Chair, Representative March, is you have a kind of a similar issue that's going to arise with the Section 5 entity and the PCO model, because that entity is not going to be at risk for hospital. So, at least financially, there is an incentive to maybe look inside the silo of those services for which they are at risk and not be as concerned. I mean, I just raised that as an issue, not be as concerned about spillover into the hospital.
Right.
Okay. That's all I got, Mr. Chairman.
I've learned to find trivial risk. I mean, trivial cost is the cost somebody else pays.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next on our list is Mr. Spate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barney Spate, representing Kaiser Permanente. Let me make a couple of comments tonight, based in part on what I heard and perhaps based in part on what I didn't hear. I'd like to point to the provisions of the bill that provide greater flexibility in the concept of managed care, primarily the issue of physician care organizations. The first fact I'd like to leave you with about physician care organizations is it's not only a testable hypothesis, it was a form of managed care that the state has extensive experience with prior to the fully capitated health plans. There clearly is, I know, Section 5 is labeled the Kaiser section, and the intent of Section 5 is to help the Department of Human Services with private sector funds to bring a physician care organization back into being so that we can play in the game in a business model that we think would work for us. But also, the bill refers to the fact that there may be other situations in the future in other communities than Portland where a physician care organization is a better managed care option than none, because it does link in a risk arrangement physician, oftentimes physician lab x-ray and oftentimes RX and other services that could be negotiated.
And Barney, if I could interrupt you and just point out, and maybe the first step may be a prelude to getting into a fully capped situation.
In some cases, there may be communities in the state where there is no managed care in the current managed care model of FCHP, where a PCO could in fact be an entry model, or in some cases it may be the only model that would work in some areas, and particularly in some of the more sparsely populated areas. One of the things I gather from the previous witness that much of his comments about the silo effect related to 6, and I'm not here to talk about Section 6, but I think there is an issue to talk about that in a physician care organization, a legitimate policy question to ask is, does that weaken the overall management of patient care across the full continuum because the physicians are not at risk for the hospital inpatient and outpatient? I would, first of all, on behalf of Kaiser Permanente, say that is not true in our model, understanding that our model is, in fact, somewhat unique to other community models, because our physicians will be practicing in the community hospitals or in Kaiser Sunnyside and will be admitting and managing those patients just as if the health plan had the risk. So the management of the patient in the inpatient or outpatient modality of the hospital is really blind. Our physicians are blind to that. I would also point out, and we can probably do some historical analysis, and I know there are other folks behind me from the Department of Human Services and OMAP that can talk about how the physician care, the PCO model was structured prior to the Oregon Health Plan, that you could actually, for a community IPA-type model, could actually build in performance incentives to assure that the state was not placed at undue risk for excessive hospital admissions, admissions that were too long, excessive outpatient because the physician community was no longer at risk. I would agree and embrace the comments of Representative Greenlich. Risk is one aspect of this, but it's not the total aspect, and there are ways to construct the PCO model to make sure that not only is the silo effect minimized, I think, personal opinion, that could actually be non-existent. So I commend the chair and others who've worked on this relative to the aspect of beginning to have a discussion, and I know we're just at the early phases of this discussion, of considering that managed care may have a definition larger or more comprehensive than the fully capitated health plan. I don't think the intent of anybody, including myself, that would advocate for PCOs is doing it to try to destroy or otherwise weaken the FCHP model. In our case, I think it allows a prepaid group practice to play in the game in the communities that we want to serve, and I think that there are potentially real-life circumstances where the PCO model will benefit the state, it'll benefit physicians in the community, and it will benefit the patients.
And let me just even strengthen those words maybe a little bit more. The bill clearly specifies that there is a priority, and that DHS shall contract in order of preference with fully capitated plans where possible, PCOs, and then obviously this isn't a contract, but fee for service. So while there is no intent, and we wrestled with this a long time, you know, how do we get to the public policy we want to achieve was more people into managed care, but how do we give, you know, certain communities, unserved or unmanaged geographic areas, or even areas in the state where there are multiple fully capped plans that have members enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan, that those plans cannot absorb that fee-for-service capacity? How do we get a management element, you know, to surround that population, or at least be able to, quote, manage that given percentage of the population? That's the policy. And I think we've achieved that in the bill in our contracting priority instructions to DHS. So that's what we're trying to get at, folks. Representative Merkley, I think, had his hand up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just if I can recap the fundamental story and see if I understand correctly. Within Kaiser, normally, a physician is thinking in terms of the entire package, because either Kaiser is going to pay for hospitalization through Sunnyside or by contracting with other hospitals provide hospitalization. Now along comes a patient who is coming through this PCO model, seeing the same doctors within the same system. The doctor is now not thinking, oh, in this case, the hospitals is not part of the continuum of risk that we care, so therefore we'll care for this patient differently. That the kind of the rhythm within Kaiser, the protocols that are set up, all take into account the broader picture, and therefore we won't necessarily have a silo problem with the PCO structure. Is that the story?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, that's a fair summary of what I said. Could I add a couple of other things, if I may?
Please.
One is that within the Kaiser Permanente system, everybody carries the same blue card. Who the sponsor of that card is, from a physician's point of view, is totally irrelevant. The second is that the amount of risk that a physician in the Kaiser Permanente system, through both the contractual relationships with a health plan and within their own medical group, the amount of that financial risk is, I would contend, relatively small to even be top of mind issue for a practicing clinician. But I want to go beyond Kaiser, because I truly believe over the years that I've been with a lot of different companies, that generally speaking, whether it's an IPA network model or any other kind of managed care company where you have significant physician involvement in the utilization management, in establishing protocols and policies relative to practices, that I simply do not believe that physicians in community medicine and fee-for-service medicine significantly differentiate care based upon payer source. In fact, I would contend that perhaps some of the weaknesses of managed care outside of prepaid group or other more tightly managed is in fact a demonstration that there are practice patterns that are dominant in a physician's practice, and it's very hard if you have 10%, 20%, or even 40% of that physician's practice to get that physician to change what he or she believes is the right way to practice. So that's just one addition that I think a PCO model outside of a prepaid group model can also deliver that same kind of non-silo, totally transparent kind of patient management.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Did Representative Greenlick have a question?
Yes, I do. I've got a couple of questions. First, a comment. I mean, I do want to comment on what Barney just said, and I think we need to listen very carefully to what he said, because I didn't comment on Karen Whitaker's statement before about the question of the ability to carry the risk of hospitalization for a relatively small medical group-sponsored managed care program, fully capitated managed care program. My experience in both Medicare and Medicaid is the thing that's frequently got even well-managed IPA kinds of capitated healthcare systems over the edge is a bad run on hospitalizations that they just literally can't control. I mean, risk has a big element of probability in it, and it's very easy to get killed on that probability for hospital care. Three or four cases of open heart surgery or one bad burn case in Klamath County could essentially wipe it out on the risk, not on the physician side. So I think with the model we have here, you may find more current fully capitated healthcare systems rather than leaving the system, opting to move to PCOs, and they could still be very beneficial. And I think what you said is an important thing. But Mr. you were out of the room before, and I'd like to ask Barney a question. I was commenting on the model we had in some of the earlier things where drugs would be cut out of capitation in a fully capitated healthcare system, and whether a well-run, fully capitated healthcare system without drugs but handled through state purchases, so you could try and get both of those things. My belief is in a well-managed IPA or something like that, that you could get the physician behavior change even though the risk wasn't there. And Barney's had a lot of experience. I mean, I know in Kaiser it wouldn't make a whit of difference. I think you were just saying that. I mean, the only thing that makes a difference is whether the patient's paying or not, not who's paying. But I wonder if your experience is that that model could work without direct risk, or with a little bit of indirect risk rather than performance risk rather than...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, I think probably the only way I can answer that, and it's somewhat of a hypothetical question, is that in the management of pharmaceuticals, risk can be very important, but I think the primary effectiveness of the management of the risk is, or the management of pharmaceuticals, is the support that the physician community that's involved in the program feels that it has over balancing the issue of good clinical care versus some external cost factor, whether they are directly at risk or indirectly at risk with an administrative fee or something like that. So it really is, my experience has been, it's been the integrative and cohesive nature of a medical community, and it can be, in the case of Kaiser, a prepaid group practice, in the case of an IPA, and particularly IPAs in communities where the IPA represents a significant Everybody. Proportion, if not 100% of the physicians, then the issues around how you manage drugs becomes, I think, much closer to the physician, and they feel much more empowered to be able to raise issues where they feel that there are real clinical questions, and to articulate exceptions and do it in a more seamless way. That's about all I can add. I understand what's attempted in six. I don't know whether we can get everything that we want. I think that, you know, I think that the comments made by the previous witness on six is possible. It may be kind of the parade of horribles, and that's something I think if we as the state go to a Section 6 model, the critical aspects of will be oversight by the state to make certain that that doesn't happen. I don't think any of us want to create that siloing where what you're actually doing is managing the drug to get a drug benefit to get an enhanced ASO fee, and everything else is discounted. I would hope that neither the company that enters into that or the medical community would want to be party to that.
And I think that's one of the areas that we need to flesh out a little bit better is what, you know, oversight capabilities do we give the department, you know, what accountability pieces, what performance standards, I mean, whatever trail we go down. This has got to be real.
Mr. Chairman, one last comment, and this will probably gather some ire, or if not wrath, from you, but I'm going to say it anyway. The doubts about, if there are at the end of lots of discussion about the Section 6 kinds of concepts, and their validity or the risks and the concerns that were spoken to earlier and may be spoken to again, I would submit that one of the careful ways for the state to consider the Section 6 concept is to enter into some limited demonstration areas, particularly in areas of the state where it can be much more controlled, where there is much more homogeneity in the medical community, et cetera, and actually test the policy. And does it have merit? And even if it did have merit in some of those demonstration projects, what we learn might lead us to say that it's not applicable everywhere, but it's applicable where there are certain environmental criteria. So it's just one more option of looking at that Section 6 model to say, maybe we can get there, maybe we can't get there in one step. Maybe we need to take a couple of years, and I'm just throwing it out that before it's discounted in its entirety, there may be some value to try it in a very controlled environment.
I'd like to see demonstrations that would allow tests of the fully capitated health plans for their members being not capitated for drugs, but do a kind of Section 6 program, so we could test ways to get both the maximal discount, the maximal rebate, and the management component. I think it's feasible to test that.
Well, keep thinking on that, and the chair will just allow that I am very, I don't want to say attached, but I think Section 6 has some real merit, and I also appreciate your suggestion about maybe some pilots. And I think all geographic areas 200 miles north and south of the 45th parallel ought to be included as a demonstration area.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Barney.
One kind of demonstration.
Gina. Let me just point out for the record that Barney was not only a member of our work group, he is also our facilitator, and I continue to have a little something for you. Enter and sign in, please.
Thank you, Chair Westland, committee members. For the record, my name is Gina Furman, and I am the director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. We have really not had time to do a thorough analysis of this. However, I do want to ask one clarifying question and give a couple comments of concerns in the brief look that we've had that we'd like to address. One is, as you know, there's a mental health organization in each county, and this bill is kind of peppered with language that would make one believe that the intent may be to put MHOs out of business. And so my clarifying question is that the intent, or questions that have been posed to me? I'm asking you, so I can take that back.
Representative Bates.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The intent of this legislation is to deal with the physical health side of health care, mm-hmm. with the exception, if you read through it carefully, you'll see that we know that about 70% of the mental health drugs are written by primary care physicians. Those are primarily the mild antidepressants and mild tranquilizers, not the antipsychotic drugs. So you see a reference in here saying drugs other than antipsychotic drugs. The intent of the legislation really is to stay away completely from mental health organizations. And if we need to amend this to make clear, we will do so. This is not in any way to regulate, deal with, or work with mental health organizations. That is going to be something that we're going to have to deal with in a separate box, which I hope we get to next week. But we've been a little busy.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification. Mr. Chair, may I add just a couple of comments that I would add that you may want to look at Section 14A, subsection 4A.
Oh, okay. Section 14A.
Correct. Basically, right now, DHS has contracts with specialty managed care organizations such as MHOs and dental organizations, and there's one chemical dependency organization. The language looks like that these organizations would be second choice of DHS in areas not covered by FCHPs. Is that correct? I mean, that's one area you might look at clarification. The other area is, of course, the much talked about Section 6. In 1A, just a brief look, this looks like it would eliminate the flexibility that DHS has to expand on targeted case management projects that MHOs have been really collaborative with FCHPs. That manage the dual members that are on medications treating mental health. So that's, I understand you're just dealing with the physical health side, but that probably needs to be clarified. And again, in Section 6.
Yes.
It's for people in fee-for-service, not for the fully capitated.
Correct.
This is for yes. fee-for-service, but I think, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I believe your concerns are sort of the same throughout this. You want to make sure the MHOs are excluded from this legislation.
And that it's clarified, that the intent is clarified. It's not clear to us.
I think we can manage to do that for you. One of the processes we're going through having hearings is get a lot of eyes on these, a lot of different people looking at it, so that if we've inadvertently done something we didn't mean to do, we can go ahead and fix that. And I appreciate what you're telling me here, because I think you're picking up something we did not directly, expressly state. We probably need to do that.
It was the intent, but not the state.
I would like to follow up, because what you said something in there about wanting to use the experience of fully capitated health plans and their relationships with MCO in the context of commenting on 1A. And what would make you think in 1A that if an MCO was managing a fee-for-service population rather than a fully capitated health plan population, they would not be able to use whatever links to the MHO that they had?
We've just done a brief look, and in our discussions with DHS and with some of the mental health organization directors, we're just concerned that our partnership doesn't get blown up by that, we just want that taken a look at. And there's several areas through here like that. And due to the time, we'll make sure that we go over this in the next couple days and get with.
Great. I think it's a point well taken, and I don't think that was the intent here. And so we thank you for bringing it to us.
Thank you.
That's why we're here. Any other questions? Okay. Thanks, Gina.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you. Representative Bates, you said that mental health is going to be addressed by a separate bill.
Didn't say that. We're ready to get to the mental health issue, hopefully, next week. I'm not sure we're going to have a bill for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
How for those of us who don't have the framework that you're putting together, how does mental health interface with this structure here, or what is the intent?
It varies tremendously all over the state, and that's one of the difficulties. There are mental health organizations that are solely separate. Some interface with fully capitated plans, and there's a mixture of them. We know now pretty clearly what we call best practices are for mental health. Those communities that have set up plans and that we call wraparound services, and I take time to explain later, get much better results for their chronically and acutely mentally ill. We want that to go across the state, and the rest of the state wants that to happen. The question is how we get there and whether we need a bill to do it or whether we need to simply do it through administrative rule or a multitude of other ways. We haven't reached that decision, and that's going to be a decision by this committee to a great degree. Mental health is basically applied in this state through two different methods, the Oregon Health Plan and another completely separate system that's outside the plan, which is just as big financially. So it's something we have to look at some more.
Let me put the question a little bit differently. When one, without the background of those discussions, looks at this bill, how does one know that when one's talking about fully capitated health plans, so on and so forth, that mental health is not included?
I think that's a very good point. That's the same one that Jenny made. And I think that we have to probably put some explicit language there to help that out. It's something that we were not considering because we were so focused on trying to get this under control. And I think we'll have to address that further.
Thank you.
Well, and I think also there's other sections of the ORS that deal with mental health. So it's found in more than one spot, and we're dealing mostly with the medical assistance program side of it here.
But we're not necessarily dealing with mental health services, right? Because I mean, we're talking about services for the severely and chronically mentally ill. I mean, you are dealing with, in this services, a variety of kind of ongoing mental health services for people who are not quite so severely diagnosed.
They're not exclusive, and they overlap. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next, Lynn Reed.
waiting so patiently.
Can't believe Lynn would have any problem with spill whatsoever.
Well, thank you for your wholehearted support.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Reed, Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Services. It's a pleasure to be here tonight, and I also want to thank you for all the work that you have put in on looking at ways to structure the Oregon Health Plan such that it will remain viable as we move into the next biennium. I spoke briefly with the absent chair before the committee, and thought that one of the things that might be helpful, since we hadn't had time to share any of our concerns with you as committee members ahead of time, if you were agreeable to this, that what I would do is just introduce on the record tonight the written document, and be prepared to come back tomorrow to do an oral presentation to walk you through any of the particular areas that may be of that you may want to focus on, and to address new issues as I know the bill is evolving.
Okay.
I do want to say, though, just that our overall view of the bill is that its primary intent appears to be to increase managed care, building off of the infrastructure that's in place today, and also to increase coordination and management of care for individuals in fee-for-service. We're very supportive of those goals, but we also think it's incumbent upon us as the probable administrators of the program to identify any areas where there may be issues of concern from our perspective, or perhaps unintentional consequences that we see that may or may not be what's intended. And so that's kind of the general way in which we present the comments that are there in written testimony.
Well, thank you. I think that would be excellent. One thing I do want to say, I think the committee members are probably thankful you didn't have more time to study this, given the length of the document you've prepared. So, any questions at this time?
Just a quick comment. I appreciate the fact that you're trying to be efficient in giving some information, but I can point out that John Kitzhaber is not governor anymore.
Oh, you're kidding.
I know.
Oh, that's excellent.
For the record, it is true. Yeah.
I think he knows.
Well, all I can say, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, that this reflects the fact that someone who does not normally put these things together pulled out some letterhead and ran this off the computer at about 5:15 tonight.
We
Thank
just
you.
Want to make sure he wasn't there. Okay, very good. We'll talk more.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Ellen Lowe.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, yeah. That's it. She's it. Unless, but we'll all ask.
Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and the perpetual consumer representative, and the reason I'm taking your time tonight is that tomorrow I'll be at Health Services Commission all day, and so trying to make sure that we do some squeezing on that list, as Chair Westland talked about it. I just have a few brief comments. One, those of you who allowed me to sit with you know that I really do support efforts to expand what I term coordinated care across the state, because I do believe it not only serves the low-income folks who are part of the Oregon Health Plan and all its configuration, but I think it also adds to the overall access for the total community as well, when you really do get all the health care providers within a community working together. And so that emphasis in this bill I applaud. I do have one concern, and or question, and Damiana alluded to it, and it was something that I saw when I began to read the bill, and I think many folks will have concerns unless there is some specific language that will relate to the opportunity for Oregonians who are under the plan, who have really unique medical conditions that require specialized services, for the plans in the various communities to be able to make sure that they are referred. And the question was asked if there are any instances, and I know there are some that have occurred across the state where Oregonians with these really unique circumstances where it's medically necessary that they perhaps have a neurologist really as their major physician, where they have become part of a fee-for-service system rather than being able to be part of the managed care system. And I can't help but feel that perhaps the language could really encourage those care systems themselves, whether they're the fully capitated plans or the PCOs or whatever acronym seems to apply to the kind of group they've put together, that they themselves really facilitate this access for families. And I know that many in Representative Westland's area do come to OHSU at CRDC, and so some plans have been far better at facilitating that kind of access. But I think that if there were some language, it wouldn't raise fears among the Oregonians who do have within their family someone in the Oregon Health Plan where it's really medically necessary for those specialized services. Another question that I have, and no one else has raised it, so maybe it's not important, but where you talk about non-emergency transportation throughout the bill, should that be non-emergency medical transportation or some qualifier? And maybe that isn't necessary, but I've wondered about it because part of the part of those anecdotes we keep hearing about the Oregon Health Plan, many of them involve alleged misuse of transportation. So I wondered about qualifying. And then something else that happened when I read the bill where our language has changed since 1989 when we first put together Senate Bill 27. And on page 3, section 7, line 35, we talk about handicapped persons. And I would hope that since we're doing some work with the bill, maybe we could change that to persons
with disabilities.
With disabilities.
Yes.
What page and line are you on, Ellen?
It's page 3, line 35.
It's persons with disabilities.
Yes.
That's persons first.
And so, and I'm 1989, we obviously use different language. Again, I want to acknowledge my appreciation for being able to participate in some of the discussions leading to this bill, and I look forward to working with you in the future.
For those
happy
of you,
to respond to any questions.
For those of you who don't know, Ellen was our conscience on the work group, and I say that in all the positive definitions of the word, and we appreciate very much you being there.
Thanks.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ellen, when you're talking about access to services, is it just a matter of being referred to appropriate specialists, or is it also being able to continue a relationship with a specialist who has a history with that patient with significant or profound problems.
Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, I was really limiting my comments to those where that ongoing relationship really is something that's medically needy, that it really is medically necessary for that person. Because I do think there are some instances where utilization has become a question and maybe the medical necessity is not there. But people with those very unique circumstances, and I know one family where it's a neurologist who gives extraordinary service over a long period of time.
Thank you.
Any other? Thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Actually, I just wanted to thank you for your service, Ellen. I know you do a lot, and I know it went without saying that we're not talking about the funding side of this and the people that aren't getting services, and I know you care about them greatly. But thank you for your work on this as well.
Thank you.
Well, as long as you're saying all those flowery words, you at least could have taken care of line 35 on page 3. I told you about that a week ago, March. That just happened. I mean, I can't believe that. Mr. Spate and Scott Gallant. Well, Gallant can probably handle this by himself. You already got your turn.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association.
But let me just interrupt you there and say that my day was going extremely well until this moment.
I'm
please
always
continue.
Pleased to help, Mr. Chairman.
There you
go. Some of my members provide what I believe to be fundamental service under this program, at least I believe that, to these particular clients. We're in a climate in Oregon that actually isn't different than some other states. If you really look north or south or east of us, because of our economic time. And while, Mr. Chairman, you have indicated that this bill is about a delivery system, what isn't being said by many of the people in this building is a recognition that other committees are going to have to address other major components that will be the potential engine to have a system to deliver services to Oregonians who might not otherwise have easy access to health care services. And it is a difficult time. And it's a very unfortunate time, and it's difficult for all of us.
Scott, can I flesh out that very good point for just a moment? We're obviously talking about a delivery system here, and I think most on the committee are at least pleased, about the process that we have at least built a foundation that will allow us, all things being equal, to cover, more people with more benefits than otherwise would have been deliverable under the old system. Having said that, just to put our plight, if you will, in perspective, Scott is exactly correct. A lot of dialogue, you hear it all the time. Well, all states are going through this. The issue is, while that's true, all states are going through this, Oregon is one of five states that has a revenue shortfall greater than 9%. In fact, we are the second highest in the nation at 18%. The only state being higher is Alaska, and that is, I think, very single industry, commodity driven, and they are probably recovering as we speak. Oregon is not. If you take our neighbor to the north, Washington, they're down $1 billion with twice the population and twice the general fund. Oregon's down over two with half the population and half the general fund. And that's an exponentially larger problem. problem. And that's what we're faced with in this building. And while Scott is correct, there are no revenue answers in this. This is at least a first step in ensuring as many services as we can possibly get to as many people as possible. And excuse me for interrupting.
Mr. Chairman, you're making me sound very articulate. Nevertheless, there are a few things I do want to mention more generally about the bill that I think are issues, fundamental issues that we all have to consider as we work through this process. And you have done very hard work in a very complex area, in some cases arcane area of law and statute that is at times difficult to deal with. And the politics of this arena are also very complex, very sensitive as well. My first point is physician capacity. I mean, what we know is that even with the population that we may be able to serve, given the resources that we have available, there may not be the physician capacity to see patients in the time frame and expectations of federal and state law or regulation, because physicians are just not able to be available for Medicaid patients and manage to keep an office and practice alive. I mean, it's a reality. It's happening in the private marketplace as well. But capacity is, in fact, an issue you have to be very, very careful about. And we'll probably talk about that more in the future. The other issue, which hasn't been touched on, is actually on page 2, and it's in another place in the bill on line 14, which is the elimination of the language about covering the cost of providing the care. That was really one of the basic principles of the Oregon Health Plan when it was first adopted, even though we all know that as time has gone by, all of our memories are different from what the original concept of the health plan was, because we seem to, you know, different people have different perceptions of what it was. But it was a lot of things. One of them was a commitment, essentially, of the state to recognize that providers were not going to make a fortune off of Medicaid patients. We never expected to, and still don't expect to. But we were at least hoping that we would have the underlying costs for treating these patients covered. The reality is we can't do that, and we haven't done it for a number of years, and it's really a fiction. However, it's an important fiction, I think, and policy position for the state. It's a goal that should be attained when we can attain it, because it really is a policy that makes sense. We do that for any other service the legislature pays for, except health care. And so I would encourage you, in spite of the reality that we're not going to get there this time or next time, nor have we the time before or the time before that, that we try to figure out some language that would still remain in the bill that tries to address that policy issue that I think is important to providers, whether they be physicians or hospitals or others who provide these services. The third point I would make is that the Medical Association and physicians have had a policy for years that multiple payment systems are a good thing. You shouldn't necessarily drive the system to one particular arena, and because different systems provide different benefits and they may have different shortfalls, et cetera. The concept in this bill is in a way similar. You have different delivery systems, fully capitated health plan approach, fee-for-service approach, which no one really likes, and it pays even more miserably. But it is a safety valve in many instances, possibly a PCO a process that may be available and may be, in fact, a safety net in some cases or an opportunity in other cases. We don't want to harm the successful systems that are community-based and are running here. But by the same token, I think we need to have the flexibility and adaptability to be able to use a PCO system or some other model where maybe the structure is very, very fragile and may not survive, or there may be other opportunities. And I would really encourage the committee to try to figure out a way to have a viable mechanism, pardon me, for that kind of process in this legislation with the implementing authority to do that, because it is, I think, an important policy. Those were really the points I wanted to raise, and maybe conclude again that, as Mr. Chairman, you said, this is a difficult time, and it is more difficult in Oregon because we are here, and it is a worse recession than we ever anticipated. And the other committees, I think, will begin the debate about whether we are at a level of resources or alternatives for finding resources to fund maybe a little more than we see on the horizon today. I would hope that you and other leaders in this building would, with education, make health care a priority. From my perspective and the physician's perspective, there have been choices previous legislatures or special sessions have made that have had a negative impact on the health plan that has been exacerbated by a continuing recession that none of us really anticipated. So we're looking forward to working with you. You've really gone a long way in this process, and if I can help, I'd be more than happy to do so. Thank you.
Scott, as always, I've appreciated working with you on the work group where you were a very collaborative member. We have talked long hours since the work group, and we will continue to talk. The one thing in your testimony I'd like to underscore is the almost cultural shift that I think is going to be needed, not only at the federal level, but in this and many other states as well, about the importance of fundamental primary health care wellness. This is something that I don't want to say it's been taken for granted, but it has been treated as a red-headed stepchild far too long, and that is the problem. We can go into the initiative process, and we can go into many other factors that have driven us to this exact point where we are in this space and time, but I think the bottom line is that we need a culture change in this country that's long overdue, and I don't know what we're going to be able to do about it at the federal level in the immediate future, and you alluded to the fact that we are going to have to put not the Band-Aid, but the Band-Aid wrapper on the artery cut again for our current situation, and I appreciate all the help you've given, and I know we'll continue to give. Thank you, Scott.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, you've pointed out the removal of the language which says the rates will cover the cost of providing this covered services. If the state is not covering those costs, what keeps providers providing fee-for-service services?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, I believe in fairly long experience of working with physicians in this state that they believe as professionals, as medical professionals, an obligation to treat Oregonians who have no coverage, have health plan coverage, and whatever, and shifting those costs or bearing those costs on their own to make sure that patients are taken care of, and they've done it year in and year out for a long, long time. And you know, ironically, in a lot of ways, past policymakers and I think future ones realize that the medical community, whether it be hospitals or physicians or other health care providers, recognize that they do that, and at times have taken advantage of it and have depended on it because we've just been unable to find the full resources to pay for their services.
If I could paraphrase, then, thank you, Mr. Chair. You don't think that will create a problem, or we're okay with making this change? See,
Maybe I misunderstand what your question is.
When you pointed out this language, I thought you were raising it as a problem. I assumed that
it is
the problem,
a problem from my perspective, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Okay. So I was assuming the problem is that underpaid physicians will mean people can't get access to services. But if that's not the problem, then what is the problem that you're pointing to? Other than you're just making the point that it's not right.
Chair.
Maybe
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Can I speak to it too?
Please.
I'll take my representative hat off and put my doctor hat on. And Scott knows as well, but maybe I feel it more because I practice medicine and seen this. The first part of the question is, do physicians get paid better in fee-for-service or in managed care? Generally speaking, they get paid slightly better in managed care. Both those are at best break-even, and in fee-for-service, frankly, for most of us, when we see an Oregon Health Plan patient, we lose money, about $5 a visit on an average. So we see this as a social contract, one that as physicians we have an obligation to care for people in our community, irregardless of the ability to pay to a great degree. We still have to be pragmatic. We've got to be able to pay our staffs and something to ourselves and so on and so forth. There is an underlying problem here, though, two really. One, that while we certainly pay for our roads to be built at full cost and we take care of other needs of the state at full cost, for some reason we chose not to do that in medicine and have this cost shifted to the rest of the people who are buying health care. That cost shift is significant. Physicians don't completely shift that. Those physicians who take on these patients significantly decrease their own income to do so. They can't shift the whole thing to the rest of the population. And unhappily, there are some physicians who choose not to take these patients. When they do that, they benefit from the higher commercial rates that are forced on the rest of the system from this cost shift. So they benefit from the cost shift and don't take their fair share of it. There's not much we can do about that, and probably isn't much we should do. The vast majority of physicians take this on as a burden. They hold it down to roughly what the percentage is in their own population. I think they should be commended for that. But the underlying problem is, for physicians and all providers, that we underfund the Medicaid system horribly, shift the cost off to the commercial markets. What we've done here is to do everything we can to make the system more efficient so that we get more bang for our buck and less cost shift. And I think that's what this whole program's about, and I think that's where we've gone with it.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a couple of other comments, and maybe at another day or time, Mr. Chairman, if you're interested, you know, it'd be good to have a discussion about the kind of the medical environment in which physicians are practicing in today's world. But the reality is that Medicare continues to be an up and down process of reimbursement. 2 years ago, there was a 5.4% cut in reimbursement. Physicians quit taking new Medicare patients. Some dropped out. It was fixed for this year at the cost of some 40 some odd $8 billion over a 10-year period. We now have another 4.2 or 3% cut looming for Medicare this next January. Medicaid pays miserably. Fee-for-service reimbursement, and I didn't really want to get into reimbursement about physicians, but the point is, it's horrible reimbursement. Clearly, the cost of seeing Medicaid patients far exceeds the amount of reimbursement that physicians are paid, whether it's managed care or otherwise, and there are limits on what physicians can do. The underlying policy of the state all these years ago about covering the cost of providing the services was to say as a matter of policy, the state recognized that they were not going to pay providers a whole bunch of money to take care of these patients where they would make a huge profit. It was, you know, we'll make a deal that will cover your costs so that you're not losing money, as an encouragement to see these patients that we know, require significant care, okay? And it just hasn't worked out that way, and we understand that. But we've been committed to the Oregon Health Plan. We can continue to be committed to the Oregon Health Plan. And we recognize and hope that one of these biennia will get to a point where the legislature, in their wisdom, will realize that the provision of health care for Medicaid patients or the unemployed or others in our structure is, in fact, a priority, and a very significant priority, and a necessary priority for any state in providing basic services to their citizens, just like education, just like public safety, or anything else. I think we all know that.
Mr.
Our
Chair,
times are just very difficult.
Sir, Representative Greenlee.
Hi. You worry about having to put up with Scott over this process, but I've been putting up with Scott for a great many years, and I share with him the experience of the design of the Oregon Health Plan, and I really want to second what he said about the policy issue, and I think his notion that we ought to be paying lip service to that policy issue, even if we can't fulfill the promise and haven't for a decade probably out of the 12 years, is a very important one. But I'd also like to comment in somewhere I'd like to have a chance to discuss with the committee when we have a little more time. The other piece that we all agree was a part of the Oregon Health Plan, and that was the part of the Oregon Health Plan that was dedicated to get employed people covered by health insurance in the existing health insurance system. And I think that's another policy piece that we ought to be paying more than lip service to in this, even if we're not prepared to move ahead and do anything about it, because part of the crisis in this, in our dealing with the Oregon Health Plan, is we have far too many people in the Oregon Health Plan who should be covered by their employers because they're fully employed, or I don't mean necessarily by their employers, but I mean through their employment. And it seems very important, again, if we have some preambles to this, and Scott points out correctly there'll be action in various committees to deal with this, I really think it's very important for us, and I'd like Scott's comment on this, to at least again pay lip service to the fact that we have to move towards strengthening our existing health insurance system in this state as a way of taking some of the burdens and the pressure off the Medicaid system.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, again, the Medical Association has had a longstanding policy about access, universal access to medical services, which is different than maybe a constitutional mandate to health care benefits for all Oregonians, but there is a difference. It is true that in the original concept of the Oregon Health Plan, their employers were, in fact, included in that package. And we fought the battle many years ago to try to retain that provision in the bill because, at the time at least, we all recognized, including at that time Associated Oregon Industries and others, that by using essentially cost shifting, we're all paying a tax, but just not one that is truly visible or express, and that we ought to recognize it, create a minimum benefit package, and balance it all out so that the state would meet its commitment. Employers with assistance from the state and the feds and others would hopefully meet theirs within reason, and you know we would improve and increase health insurance coverage in the state. And even without that mandate, because of the economy in part, and I think because of the health plan in part and other component parts of it, that were developed over time, you know, we really have improved coverage. The problem is that the economy is, to say the least, you know, in deep trouble. And employers, and we're a small employer state, are having to adjust their expenses in order to survive during this recession. Is it the right policy that we have universal access to health services at reasonable premium rates? Absolutely. Would we be able to get there in this political environment in the near future? I don't think so. Do I think the public is beginning to consider whether it is a policy debate that this state and other states, maybe nationally, need to begin to really discuss? I think it's coming, and I think it'll come sooner rather than later as we go through this process.
Any other questions for Mr. Gallant? Scott, as always.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any comments by the committee?
Let's go home.
Let's go home. Before we do, I was out of the room when Lynn Reed and Jim Edge testified.
Lynn Reed's going to come back, and she entered in, she gave us some information and said she would come back and discuss it.
Maybe. I've glanced through the document that the department has provided us, and while there are some points in here I certainly agree with, and I see some catches in here, Lynn, that you and I and Gene and Aaron have already discussed and agreed to, that there are some points obviously I agree with, some points obviously I disagree with. The reason I'd like to mention Mr. Edge and Ms. Reed is the very collaborative nature that they've participated in this process with us. And you want to talk about people that have an extremely onerous workload, and you start to look what the department's been through in 5/6 special sessions, a couple rebalances, a failed revenue measure, and then this exercise in redefining how healthcare services are delivered to the Oregon Health Plan, not to mention all those other little issues they deal with, like long-term care and adult and family services and DD, medically fragile. We appreciate you. Thanks for being here. See you again. Keep up the great work. We're adjourned.